Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the positive reviews coming from media pundits and across the country, praising Donald Trump's first presidential moment in last night's address to Congress, when he managed to follow the teleprompter and control his impulse to go off script and lash out at enemies real or imagined. Michael Cruz, a senior staff writer at Politico, joins us to discuss his latest article at Politico. He's a performance artist pretending to be a great manager. Donald Trump sits at the top of the biggest org chart in the world. Why does he look so uncomfortable in the job? We'll discuss the difference between performance and policy, grandstanding and governing, and whether Trump can maintain the discipline necessary to live up to the glowing praise he is now getting from conservative and liberal commentators on both Fox News and CNN. Then we look further into the gap between Trump's actions and words and speak with Eric Liu, the founder of Citizen University and the author of the forthcoming book, You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. He joins us to discuss his article at CNN, A Master of Symbols Over Substance. And we will discuss what citizens can do to hold Trump and other politicians' feet to the fire so that their populist promises withstand the demands of their plutocratic patrons. Then finally, we will speak with a former White House speechwriter to get an assessment of Trump's speech and the Democratic rebuttal that seemed peculiar and off-key, especially considering the explosion of activism with massive and sustained demonstrations and boisterous town hall meetings where citizens at the grassroots appear to be way out ahead of their political parties. Paul Glastris, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly, who was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, joins us. And joining us now is Michael Cruz, who's a senior staff writer at Politico. His latest article at Politico is, he's a performance artist pretending to be a great manager. Donald Trump sits at the top of the biggest org chart in the world. Why does he look so uncomfortable in the job? Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cruz.
Thanks, Ian.
And, of course, Michael, the reviews from last night's speech to the joint session of Congress by Donald Trump pretty unanimous in the sense that he did himself a favor by sticking to the script and as perhaps his most presidential moment so far. So in terms of being a performance artist, that paid off, right?
Yeah, absolutely. This is exactly what he wanted out of last night and frankly what he needed given what many of the polls were showing increasingly, about 6 or so weeks into his presidency. You know, Trump is a gifted performer and performance artist, and as a member of the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, he knows that a heel who's never anything other than a heel is a dead-end story. A heel needs to be a hero here and there, just on occasion, to get people to keep watching. And so it was high time for President Trump to be something other than a heel, and serial drama needs ebbs and flows. And last night, Trump delivered, a more measured speech, his most measured speech probably ever, certainly since the wee hours of November 9th and the immediate aftermath of his victory. And he now is more or less, substance aside, basking in the glow of those rave reviews and positive press for a change.
So we've obviously had an actor as a president, Ronald Reagan, and Donald Trump's a member of the Screen Actors Guild, as it happens. He's a seasoned performer on The Apprentice, etc. I recall that James Carville once said that politics is show business for ugly people, but in this case, he's got some practice there. But he also, but as a person, not as a performer, he does have impulse control problems, and he seemed to be able to hold them at bay last night.
Over the course of time, certainly, and as a whole, he has impulse problems. He also, though, throughout his career and throughout the campaign and now during his still brief presidency, he has shown the ability to identify a moment when it is necessary for him to alter the narrative. And certainly he needed to do that heading into last night. And that's, that is precisely what he did. I mean, the question here is, can he is what the question always is. Can he deliver on the grandiose promises he has been making, and he made certainly last night? Can you fix health care, repeal and replace, institute an entirely new health care setup, and do it for less money, better coverage without driving up the debt, while you're also adding $50 billion to defense spending and building a wall across the southern border, for instance? These are the much larger questions. I think from a performance aspect, we will continue to see these sort of moments where Trump does backtrack a little bit and become much more subdued, because that's what's called for, and he will be re-hailed as quote-unquote presidential because he precisely because he didn't do what he has become known so well for doing.
Well, but in a way, though, so far, it's been government by stunt. And again, that goes to the performance, not to the substance, not to, you know, very little has been done. In fact, the only, as far as I know, he did sign a bill actually yesterday enabling mentally ill people to buy firearms, which is a whole other subject to discuss, but hardly a great achievement. So what's your sense then of whether this will continue? In other words, you could argue that last night was a series of stunts as well, particularly with the widow of the SEAL who died, and there's some culpability on the part of the president, at least as far as the father of the slain special warrior. And of course, Trump, to some extent, passed the buck on Fox News yesterday by blaming the generals for the loss of Ryan. But the widow was there last night, and it did seem like that's, in terms of impulse control, that was the one moment where Donald Trump couldn't contain himself. He had to say something about the applause, that it broke a record. I mean, how did that strike you?
Well, certainly there is that. But at the same time, it struck me as a moment that played extraordinarily well on the whole for many viewers, many of the 40 million people who tuned in for the speech. That is what they will remember, and they'll remember it favorably if they remember anything from in the long run from last night. I mean, look, here is the thing. Trump is a so-so businessman and a so-so manager, and that's always been the case, but he is a master at telling his own story. I mean, this is and has always been and continues to be his great, great gift, the thing that enables all other things. You know, in the early 1990s, when he was all but dead financially, he was already crafting his comeback narrative, and that's how he considered it. He considered it as a comeback. He is the director of his own movie. He is the star of his own show. This is how he sees his very existence, and it has worked. You know, he's been divorced twice, but he's not seen by the public as a failed husband and father. He's seen as a sex symbol. He's a guy who has filed for bankruptcy after bankruptcy, owning casinos, for Pete's sake, where the house is always supposed to win, and the house always does win, unless you're being run by Donald Trump. And he has managed to cast himself as the nation's best businessman, first on The Apprentice, and now for real. And it has worked. It has worked for him because perception is reality, and he understands that better than anybody. He's always sort of intuitively understood that, and now the fact that he is the president of the United States is sort of the ultimate testament to how absolutely true that has become. Perception is reality, and people see him. People see him as a straight talker, even though his record of statements is nothing if not inconsistent. People see him as a business ace and sort of the ultimate boss, even though that record is certainly spotty. He is a genius in this respect, and you see it on a regular basis. He understands that we collectively as a culture have, you know, ADD, and it's getting worse, and we forget after last night and moments like last night, we forget, even just briefly, all these other things, you know, all these other things he's said and done and not said and not done. And he creates a positive news cycle for himself, which will carry on until he does something else, which is, you know, we'll see. But it's only a matter of time.
So in terms of performing versus governing, it would seem to me that one of the things that explains Trump, and you have done so in your article at Politico, Michael Cruz, is the extent to which he's run a private company, and it's, you know, a very small group of people, and it's a totally authoritarian situation where he's in charge. It's a privately held company, and indeed most of his cabinet also come from that world of privately held companies, which I guess allows Stephen Bannon to attack corporate America and globalism because they're all publicly held companies. But in terms of some of the stuff that the New York Times reported about Trump wandering around the living quarters in the East Wing as though he's sort of like a character out of Shakespeare, banging into the walls in his robe, tweeting and watching cable news through the wee hours of the morning and tweeting, etc. There was a sense that he's almost like he's trapped. Maybe the Russian story is bothering him, or the fact that he's out of his depth is bothering him. How much can the bluster and bravado of this man overcome the inadequacy? Because I don't even think he thought he was going to win, and we don't even know exactly the motives for him running in the first place, whether they were to improve his brand and whether it was a lark or whatever it was. Now we're stuck with him, and he's stuck in the Oval Office. Do you think he can maintain the bluff, if indeed that is the case?
You know, it's tough to say. It's impossible to say. But I guess I would just offer this idea that for a long, long time, certainly for the last year and a half, ever since he got into the presidential race, many people have been saying that the jig will be up when this or that or the other thing happens, and he's 6 weeks into his time as the 45th president of the United States. So I don't know. I don't know when he will meet a point when he is truly in over his head, or when he truly can't bluff his way out of a situation. I don't know. I don't know anybody. I don't know that anybody can know that for sure, but he certainly has used his idiosyncratic style, however you want to describe that, to get to the tip top of the world's power chart. So, gosh, I don't know. I don't even know how to answer that question. I think we're just watching and monitoring and reporting and waiting.
Well, in terms of the political opposition, what did you make of the Democratic response? I mean, it seemed so completely wrong to me. Visually, it looked strange. And, you know, you've got some rising stars on the Democratic stars, at least in terms of the only place where he can be held accountable. When in the U.S. Senate, you've got people like Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, etc. What did you think of that in terms of signaling that the opposition's alive and well, to have a former governor who's not even in office anymore sitting at a diner with a bunch of old folks sort of looking stunned?
Holding very, very still, yeah. it was awkward. It was awkward, as you said, visually. I mean, I think for the most part, the substance of the rebuttal was satisfactory, but the fact that it was coming from a former, not a current, or not even a future, was a little bit odd too. I think it was a reflection, though, of the difficult spot, of course, that the Democratic Party finds itself in. Their rising stars, or certainly the people, or some of the people expected to be in the 2020 field running against Trump, like Cory Booker, are already fairly well known, very well known, and don't need really to put themselves in a scenario, in a setting, in that rebuttal that hasn't always been the friendliest setting, and is a sort of a difficult position to be in and to come out of looking good. It also strikes me that people like Cory Booker or Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris or any of the people who are sort of more coastal, more liberal, more outwardly, overtly anti-Trump voices in the Democratic Party in 2017 do not speak to at all to the people in places like Kentucky, where former Governor Beshear was coming to you from, where they need to win some people back to not only win in 2020, but much more importantly, win seats back in the House and in the Senate, because that's ultimately where things get done. And it certainly makes it more easy, as we saw in the Obama years, if you've got Congress on your side as well. So, you know, I don't know that there was an immediately available and willing, more logical candidate to offer that rebuttal than the one they had, the one they put out there last night.
Well, just in closing, Michael Cruz, then that I imagine is really the issue here in terms of, one, whether the Democrats can win back power, or two, whether Donald Trump is the populist that he ran as, or is he the plutocrat, as his cabinet would indicate, and his entire background would indicate. I mean, in other words, the people in Kentucky and in the red states that voted for him, I guess they have got to either, he's either going to succeed or fail. And if he fails, they got to learn the hard way. And of course, the rest of the country becomes collateral damage. So is there any other way, a short of something happening with this Russian story that looms in the background? Or is that the situation that, in other words, it seems to me that if Donald Trump is a fraud, then he has to fall under his own weight, as opposed to finding some way to perhaps even impeach him.
Again, though, whether or not he is a success or a failure, or his administration is a success or a failure for those people who voted for him in places like Kentucky or West Virginia or Wisconsin or Ohio or Pennsylvania, is not only going to be a function of reality, of whether or not those people get back the jobs they lost or what have you. It's going to be a question of how those people see it and how they feel about it. And the track record of Donald Trump is, one, he will be a failure for them, or be a fraud, to use your word, but two, not everybody will hold him to account and, in fact, consider him a failure. They might not, because there have been many, many cases in the past where people haven't been able to parse that and make those distinctions. You know, I think the question is, will those voters, if this goes the way I think many people think it will go, that these jobs were long gone and aren't coming back, in these sorts of places, that there'll be different kinds of jobs. If it does play out that way, will those voters be more like, feel more like the spurned shareholders of his casino companies, who really did feel, you know, that loss of those investments? Or will they be like sort of the watchers of The Apprentice, who don't necessarily feel it personally and still consider him to be wildly successful?
Well, Michael Cruz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Cruz, who's a senior staff writer at Politico, and he has his latest article at Politico is, he's a performance artist pretending to be a great manager. Donald Trump sits at the top of the biggest org chart in the world. Why does he look so uncomfortable in the job? We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking further into the gap between Trump's actions and words.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Eric Liu, who's the founder of Citizen University and the author of several books, including The Gardens of Democracy and The Accidental Asian. He previously served as a White House speechwriter and a policy advisor to President Bill Clinton. And his forthcoming book out soon is You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. And he has an article at CNN, A Master of Symbols Over Substance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Liu.
Hello, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Eric. And in terms of your, I take it that's your analysis of Donald Trump's speech at the joint session last night, that this was a case of a master of symbols over substance. But I have to tell you that he's getting very good reviews around the country.
Well, to be clear, in saying that he's a master of symbols over substance, I meant only partially to criticize him. The other part actually is to sort of is to tip one's hat at the fact that, you know, symbols over substance is a pretty good formula for success in American politics. And what Trump did yesterday, not only in modulating his tone, which is what a lot of people focused on, but really speaking in broad thrusts and using these, you know, photo op moments, whether it's CEOs agreeing to keep jobs in the U.S. or most notably, you know, paying homage to the widow of the Navy SEAL up in the gallery there. He uses these symbolic moments in a way that play to his strength, which is theatricality and performance. They are not moments meant for the nitty-gritty of governing, which, by his own admission, the day just before giving the speech yesterday, he had admitted that, boy, healthcare is a lot more complicated than I realized or anybody realized. And he's not so good at the actual running of government, but he's quite good at the performance side of leadership. And I don't mean to be damning with faint praise, but that actually is something that he's instinctively skillful at.
So do you think he can keep out of his own way? Because his obviously lack of impulse control, tweeting, people getting under his skin, lashing out all over the place, that has characterized this interregnum between the very dark inaugural speech to this speech that's being highly praised from last night.
Yeah, I think I think in a couple more Twitter cycles, and certainly a couple more turns of the news cycle, and I think for the most part, last night's speech will be forgotten. The calm and the self-control that he generally exuded last night, while still, to be clear, advancing policies that were incredibly divisive. And incredibly cruel in a way, both to undocumented immigrants, to people of color who've been on the wrong end of police injustice and police violence. Though his tone was modulated yesterday and he was under control, I have a feeling that's going to prove to be the exception rather than the rule. That said, it did give you a taste. If somehow he or his his handlers actually managed to keep him in some boundaries of self-discipline, it did give you a taste of how dangerous he could be to Democrats by effectively staying at levels of high generality, keeping people in a left-right way off balance by making nods to things that some Democrats and labor might like infrastructure investments, while speaking, you know, tough about eradicating ISIS and so forth. And but I think, you know, you pose the question in a way that almost answers itself, can he get out of his own way? And nothing in his track record in public life suggests that over the long term he can.
Well, the explanation that's being offered up by reporters at the Washington Post is that Ivanka, his daughter, weighed in on him. And not only did he throw her a bone with mentioning a couple of her projects, like, you know, pregnancy leave and childcare, etc. But he also apparently did take her advice on not being inflammatory, being conciliatory, and, you know, reaching out to the Democrats.
Number one, that is the classic kind of story that circulates in Beltway media. When someone who's close to Ivanka wants to inject that storyline into the broader narrative, and unnamed sources tell reporters things like that. But again, more broadly, this is a man whose method in public life is pretty well set. And if it turns out that he is capable of modulation and growth and self-control in ways that are not just as a matter of surface style, but actually on substance, well, then, you know, people should welcome that. But I think, as President Reagan once said of the Soviets, you know, if you want to trust that, you've got to verify, too. And there's very little cause for either trust or verification thus far.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Liu, who's the founder of Citizens University and the author of several books, including The Gardens of Democracy and Accidental Asian. He previously served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor to President Bill Clinton. And his forthcoming book is You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. And he has an article at CNN, A Master of Symbols Over Substance. When you mentioned a streak of cruelty, there's no question that unit that he wants to set up at the DOJ, which is dedicated to victims of crimes committed by undocumented immigrants. It almost sort of was a bookend for his opening remark when he announced his presidency, where he talked about all these rapists and coming in from Mexico and et cetera. So that's clearly not a sign of any kind of progress. And it seems to me such a token, you know, if he's going to, he doesn't even know where he's going to get the $54 billion extra dollars for the DOD to up its budget to $603 billion. And by the way, $54 billion is the entire amount that the Russians spend on defense per year. So,
well, you just, by the way, Ian, you just said a word that didn't get uttered yesterday, which was Russia.
Right.
and I think one of the, you know, one of the, again, it is, it is one of the responsibilities of citizens right now. Frankly, whether you are a fan of the president or a critic, to take a longer view and to not be acting, responding, or digesting impressions on the metabolism of Twitter, which is to say on the metabolism of this man in the White House right now. In a slightly longer view, the fact of the matter is that this is a president whose acts right out of the gate were both incredibly divisive and have really served to, you know, in a way, actually revitalize a sense of bottom-up citizen power and responsibility in reaction and response to his deeds. And so, you know, we are, as calm as last night seemed, we are in the midst of a period of incredible political and civic turbulence right now. That was the case even before he became president. But since he's been president just in this short month, he has very deliberately disrupted things in a way that, you know, I think belie any notion that we're about to have a, quote, new Trump or a, quote, normal presidency now. You know, I think, again, from the vantage point of the work that we do, which is cross-partisan, cross-ideological work to activate citizen power and citizen voice right now, I actually think this is an exciting time. You know, as Trump overreaches in a variety of ways, both rhetorically and programmatically, citizens are responding, not just progressives who are angry and going to the women's march, marches around the country, but libertarians who are deeply troubled by his overuse of executive authority, reform conservatives who find very little that is actually conservative, judicious, or prudent in this president's both method of governing and mannerisms, and people across the political spectrum right now who are realizing, holy cow, I've got to get off the sidelines and actually get on the field here and start to participate, organize, advocate, and make sure that the worst possible outcomes from a president like this don't ever come to pass.
Well, clearly there's been an almost unprecedented demonstration of spontaneous grassroots activism. I mean, you've had millions of women showed up the day after the inauguration, and since then there have been town hall meetings that people have come to, and of course Trump and the Republicans have tried to dismiss it as some kind of Democratic dirty trick, but I think it's pretty clear that these people are genuine constituents and they're genuinely concerned, and they're putting their politicians, their representatives, on the hot seat, which is where they deserve to be, and that's how democracy is supposed to work. So I see this moment we're in as a lot of political energy in search of strategy. So then you ask yourself, where's the Democratic Party in terms of strategy? They put up this rather peculiar response to Donald Trump that seemed to be completely off key.
Well, I think, it is true that there is a lot of energy right now. And it is also true that there's no single strategy, much less a single commander among Democrats and progressives. But I actually don't think that's a liability. I think over the long term, that is an asset. The nature of progressive politics in general is that, you know, it's herding cats. There never is a single person or a single organization that ends up being the focal point, much less a single, you know, song sheet that everybody sings off of. This is why progressives are progressives. Just constitutionally and temperamentally, they're not inclined to fall in line and conform that way. But that said, even apart from that, I think that is that is an asset and a virtue, because in this day and age right now, again, on a Twitter metabolism and this incredibly fragmented media ecosystem we're in right now, you can't just have a single strategy and a single commander in response to Donald Trump. There have to be surges of reaction and action from all corners of the ecosystem, and in ways that are quite uncoordinated and ways that are quite unplanned. Take, for example, you mentioned the town meetings that have been happening in congressional districts around the country. As you probably well know, the coordination of that work happened in an incredibly bottom-up, sideways way. It was not Central Command, Democratic Party headquarters dictating it. It was a group of former staffers who put out a document on Facebook a few weeks ago called Indivisible, giving citizens a simple playbook of how to show up at town meetings, how to apply useful pressure on members of Congress, what not to do. And that document went viral. And that document in turn became the catalyst for a lot of on-the-ground, face-to-face organizing in communities around the country that ultimately enabled folks to show up with the force and voice and numbers that they did at town meetings. That wasn't anybody's master plan. That wasn't even anything that existed 5 weeks ago. And I think the folks on the progressive side have to trust that a complex, adaptive ecosystem will yield responses in just the way that the body politic, like the body, will generate an immune response. And it's not just about the brain telling the body to respond to a virus.
Well, what can the Democrats do, though, in terms of pointing out that the rhetoric is one thing and the reality is another? Or as you say in your CNN piece, it's a question of symbols over substance. We've seen the symbols. Let's get down to the substance. Now, he just signed an executive order overturning the Clean Water Rule. That's no way in the world is that a good thing for anybody in this country. And the first bill that he signed yesterday was a bill that allows mentally ill people to purchase firearms. That's hardly a good thing for the country. So how can the Democrats or the opposition, since there's a lot of grassroots opposition out there, and as you just pointed out, the Indivisible people came, that all happened virally without anything to do with the DNC. So is there a way to keep his feet to the fire? Because this same president that all of these pundits are gushing over, basically on Monday at the White House when the governors were there, Trump told the governor of Pennsylvania that all of these anti-Semitic attacks were a kind of false flag operation conducted by Obama's people. I mean, you know, crazy Alex Jones conspiracy stuff. And I suspect that this is more who this man is in the White House than the person that they're praising today.
Well, I think that is right. And I think what any citizen, again, I don't really want to fixate only on Democrats in opposition. Any citizen right now, any member of the community who feels like this president and the choices he's making are a net harm to the community has to do a couple of things. Number one, of course, begin to organize. And I think that organizing has to happen face-to-face. There is a decades-long atrophying of citizen muscle in our communities around the country. And it's not going to get rebuilt overnight, but I think this is a moment where many people are coming together to form circles, to educate each other, to actually decode the news of the day, and to think about what particular actions will they focus on as a group, you know, for the next X period of time. I know that there is sometimes a feeling of paralysis among activists or would-be activists, citizens who are interested bystanders and trying to decide whether to get into the game. There can be a sense of paralysis of, gosh, there are too many issues. I don't know where to begin. Should it be on clean water and clean air? Should it be on, you know, protecting the undocumented? Should it be on, you know, rolling back these reckless, irresponsible gun policies? The short answer is pick something. You know, again, you should pick something, and you should gather a few other folks who feel similarly strongly about that something. And whether that something becomes the issue of the day or the defining issue of this presidency, we can't know right now. But if everybody decides to pick something and begins to self-organize around something, then again, collectively, the body politic will be able to hold Trump in. But, the most harmful thing right now would be kind of a self-fulfilling sense of paralysis and powerlessness that makes people think, like, oh, gosh, there are too many issues and Trump has too much control of the initiative here, and it's not worth my getting involved. That becomes a deeply self-fulfilling prophecy that all of us have to resist.
Well, Eric Liu, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Liu, who's the founder of Citizen University and the author of several books, including The Gardens of Democracy and The Accidental Asian. He previously served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor to President Bill Clinton, and his forthcoming book is You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. And he has an article at CNN, A Master of Symbols Over Substance. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an assessment from a former White House speechwriter of Donald Trump's speech last night. I'm amazed at what the people say. I'm amazed by a divided nation. I'm amazed at the love we rejected. I'm amazed what we accepted as place. After all you said and done. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Paul Glastras, who's the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton and wrote over 200 speeches for the president on subjects ranging from education to health care to the budget. Before joining the White House, Paul Glastras spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News & World Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Glastras.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And suddenly Donald Trump is being declared presidential. Fox News anchor Chris Wallace says, I feel like tonight Donald Trump became the president of the United States. And on the liberal side, Van Jones at CNN said he became president of the United States. So prior to that, in the interregnum between the inauguration, I'm not sure what he was, but most of what has been going on in the White House has been characterized as chaos and dysfunction. What was your take on this speech last night?
Well, if you just looked at this speech and didn't look at his tweets and his, you know, rallies and his rants and his fights and so forth of the previous 4, 5, 6 weeks, you would think, well, that looked kind of like a pretty typical presidential first speech to Congress. It had, you know, a lot of the right grace notes, He was calmish, it felt like proper speechwriters wrote a proper speech. You know, not talk about the substance of what he said. It just, the visuals and the sound and the rhetoric were normal. So in that sense, I suppose, yes, he became president. At least he played the part of president for an evening.
So what do you think then is the case here going forward? Is this this is a change? I guess that we're all guessing here whether
I think we just don't know.
Right.
But you know, there have been these false starts all through the campaign. He would come out. You'll recall, I guess this was in the early fall, where the campaign staff tried to rope him in and get him to use a teleprompter, and for a week or so he did, and they seemed to say, you know, things have calmed down. And then he'd go off the rails again. And because it never hurt him, he did win the White House, and the polls were always, decent for him. He's had really no interest or incentive to do otherwise. On this one, he and his staff probably determined he needed to play this one straight. He did, but, I have no expectation that he will continue to. I just think it'll be the Trump we've known, with occasional moments of sanity.
Well, I think it's worth noting, surely, Paul Glass, just that Donald Trump is a performer. He's a member of the Screen Actors Guild. He's a reality TV star. He had his show, The Apprentice. He's always been a salesman and a public figure. Surely we should be able to sort of separate, the performance from the policy.
Well, I guess as a performer, he's sort of like Dustin Hoffman and Tootsie, right? Very strong-minded, very disputatious, in the right role at the right moment, brilliant, but... I don't think he's inhabited the presidency yet, to be quite honest. A proper president would not have waited day upon day upon day to say something comforting and wise and presidential about the attack on Jewish cemeteries. Finally, in the first moments of this speech, he did say something, but that's not what presidents do. No president in the past would have thought it was a good idea to let something like that sit out there and not do his job. I'm a performer, but an unusual one, to say the least.
Well, when you mentioned Paul Glasters, how tardy he was on dealing with the these desecrations of Jewish cemeteries and over 160 bomb threats to Jewish community centers, which have been going on for some time. And as you recall, when an Israeli journalist asked Donald Trump about the press conference with Netanyahu, Trump started to talk about what a great victory he had in the election. And then when an Orthodox journalist at a press conference at the White House asked Donald Trump about what was going on in terms of this outbreak of anti-Semitism in the United States, Trump insulted this journalist and told him to sit down. So it's been very strange. But it's worth noting, though, that I believe it was on Monday that Donald Trump met with the Republican governors, and he told the governor of Pennsylvania that he believed that these anti-Semitic attacks were being orchestrated by the Obama people and by the opposition as a kind of false flag operation. It's almost as though he got that idea from Alex Jones. So that's a very different president from the one that we saw last night.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we have a lot more of moments, more consistently moments like that, conspiracy theory at the Governor's Association than we do moments like last night's speech.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Glastris, who's the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and a senior fellow at the Western Policy Center. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton, where he wrote over 200 speeches for the president. And before joining the White House, Paul Glastris spent 10 years as a correspondent editor at U.S. News and World Report. So let's turn to the Democratic response, which you have to admit was a little bizarre. I must say, when you've got an opposition on the rails, you've got obviously there's in many ways the Democratic grassroots are way ahead of their political leaders. They're out in the hundreds of thousands demonstrating. There's a tremendous amount of political energy and angst about Donald Trump. And the party, Democratic Party, puts up the former governor of Kentucky in a strange setting. Well, I won't characterize any further. I want to get your take on it.
Well, these responses are almost always no-win situations for whoever does them. I've seen, a lot worse. I've seen a few that are better. You're just at a disadvantage as the out-of-power party, not having, had a chance to see the president's speech in advance before you write yours, responding to something you haven't heard in a setting that's not anything like as magisterial as the one the president had. So that said, I think it wasn't as bad as you do. I mean, they had a choice, right? The Democrats could have gone with somebody who represented the future of the party, Cory Booker or, Kamala Harris or somebody like that. But they chose Beshear, Governor Beshear, and there was a logic to it. And the logic would be, whether whether it's persuasive or not, that what they really wanted to do was focus on Obamacare. That's where the Republicans are weakest right now. And like a boxer who, draws blood, draws a cut above the eye of the opponent, you keep hitting the cut. And that's what they did with Beshear. They, he is kind of the hero of the one red state governor who got Obamacare, who expanded Medicaid, and has, probably done the best job of managing the Obamacare ACA system. And, he's somebody that the people who need to be persuaded and made miserable are Republican congressmen and Republican voters who are having to decide, how much pain do we want to cause the country by repealing Obamacare? So this was an attempt to get somebody who spoke like a Southerner, is a Southerner, a veteran and all that, to say, hey, we made Obamacare work just fine in Kentucky. What's the matter with you all? So it wasn't a way to rally the whole base of the Democratic Party. It was a way to mess with the minds of the Republicans. And remember, in any State of the Union or speech like this, the majority of the people who watched that speech typically are the supporters of the president who's speaking. The opposition folks tend to tune it out. Probably a lot of liberals just didn't have the stomach to watch it, but lots of Trump voters did. So this was, I think there was a logic to that choice.
So the one thing that he was very short on policy and certainly on details, and whatever he was promising there was extremely lacking in details. The one thing that he did mention, which seemed a little odd, was setting up this, I can't remember the acronym he had for it, but setting up a special unit in the Justice Department for victims of crimes perpetrated by immigrants, illegal immigrants. And he did, in fact, have some people in there, so families of some victims. But there's no proportionality there, is there? I mean, I don't know that there's a rash of victims of undocumented immigrants in this country. It's not
that was really the most deplorable one of the most deplorable things about the speech, and it was the insinuation against all evidence that immigrants commit a disproportionate number of crimes. In fact, immigrants commit a smaller number of crimes per capita than native-born Americans. But, you know, that was the message he ran on. Again, remember, this was not a speech to the American public. This was when Donald Trump speaks, it's best to presume that he's not speaking to the broad public, he's speaking to his base. That's true, frankly, of both parties increasingly over time. It is more true of Republicans, and it's most true of Donald Trump. So this is what he ran on. And, you know, even though the numbers show the opposite, we know Donald Trump has profited by saying things that apparently a sizable number of Americans believe to be true and want to hear. And that was what that was all about.
So how do the Democrats handle this? Obviously, the out-of-control, dysfunctional, chaotic Trump is a gift to them. And my understanding is that it's even got Pence and Ryan and McConnell worried, the chaos in the White House, because it sort of slows down their agenda, which has led some people who oppose Trump to suggest, well, maybe it's better that we keep Trump in there and they don't impeach him over the Russian stuff, assuming the smoking gun eventually emerges there. So if indeed Trump's going to be more disciplined, follow the script, not be so impulsive, not, you know, react in this way that he does with the tweeting out stuff, how do they adjust their strategy, if indeed they have a strategy?
Well, first of all, we don't know that he's going to become more disciplined. He was disciplined for a night. So we'll see. Number two, there's a bigger problem than his indiscipline that the Republicans have, and that is the ideas, their policies, their agenda. They don't have the votes within the Republican Party for even one item on their agenda, right? They disagree on how to repeal and replace Obamacare, and understandably so, because there's no good way to do it that doesn't create tremendous political pain and blowback. So there's not enough votes in the Republican Party to do that. And I think one of the things you heard last night was Donald Trump basically begging the Democrats to save him and come join the effort to fix Obamacare. First he said he was going to repeal and replace it, but then he kind of implied he wanted to mend, don't end the thing. So he knows he needs votes outside of the Republican Party to somehow get a majority. And one thing Democrats can do is, you know, not play along, not give him any votes at all on that. Why should they? I see no reason why they should. On taxes, there's just big disagreements about things like this, border tax that they want to put, which would make it easier for exporters and harder for importers. Maybe not a bad idea, but it pits the Walmarts of the world against the Boeings of the world. And, different parts of the Republican Party think differently on different parts of that. And, that gets to the whole tax reform part of it, which, again, they don't have unanimity about. And they certainly don't have unanimity about the budget. So what Democrats, I think, are doing is sitting back and providing zero help at this point. What I think they should do is pick their battles, because they are strongest when they're unified. With unified Democratic voting, they can make the lives of these Republican lawmakers a living hell. But there are going to be issues where the Democrats simply aren't going to be unified, like on infrastructure. You know, personally, if it were me, I'd tell the Democrats, don't let him spend a dime on infrastructure. I know Democrats have talked about it for 8 years, But it's, you know, it's 2017, not 2009. We don't need a big Keynesian jolt to the economy right now. And, you know, why give Donald Trump help, juice jacking up the economic spending? But that's not going to happen because Democrats, you know, the union Democrats want that money. The African American, the Congressional Black Caucus wants that money for their inner city, create some jobs. There's just too much demand within the Democratic Party, so you can't unify around that. So you're going to have to figure out a different strategy that provides some unity that will be, you know, that will be one in which the Democrats are, in a sense, working with Donald Trump. But that's not bad. Democrats can, that nothing on infrastructure will pass without the Democrats because too many Republicans don't want to spend a whole lot of money on infrastructure. So Democrats can basically decide, you know, hold the whole thing hostage and get, you know, more precisely what they want. So, you know, we call that, at the Washington Monthly, we've coined the term strategic co-opposition. figure out the positions that the Democrats can get unity around and stick to those.
Well, just in closing, though, the proposal that Trump has put forth is pretty much smoke and mirrors. Such a big component in it is these tax credits. And you know, in effect, you give you. I don't know how you can go ahead and build roads and airports and bridges and sewers and water mains without money. I mean, you know, who's going to put it? It's one thing to give tax breaks, but it's another thing to actually pony up the money.
Well, no, his particular plan, or the one floated by his advisors in December, whenever it was, is nonsense and should be. No Democrat should come near it. But there are ways of crafting this so that the federal government puts in some money, state and local governments put in some money, developers who are going to benefit from the infrastructure, say if you're going to build a new light rail, the developers who own the land around the light rail stops are going to make a fortune. They ought to pay something out of their profits to build the light rail. So there's ways of getting the private sector involved that are fair and equitable, as well as, state and local governments, so that you share the costs of it. But the federal government's going to have to put in some money, and the federal government could put in some money, and well should. But it's it should be done for the things that make sense for the public and not kind of just what Steve Bannon has said are these huge, you know, indiscriminate building of dams and dredging of ports and whatever. I just don't see that, right now that it's in the Democrats' interest to support that kind of stuff.
Well, Eric, Paul Glastris, I'm going to let you attend to your dog.
Yeah, sorry about that, yeah.
And I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Glastris, who's the editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly. He was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton and wrote over 200 speeches for the president. And before joining the White House, he spent 10 years as a correspondent and editor at U.S. News & World Report. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.